Good evening and welcome to Art Waves. I'm Bernadette Rule, and tonight my guest is Life Ping. Life Ping is a Canadian artist and teacher with experience in advertising, editorial, and illustration at the local, national, and international levels. He enjoys exploring all levels of art, especially graphic art. He works in all styles, from line drawing to full color, from cartoons to the most sophisticated stylized artwork. And this past year, he's discovered the delight of painting oil landscapes. Life Ping teaches graphic art at Mohawk College. Welcome to Art Waves, Life Ping.
Thanks, Bernadette. It's nice to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here, and I would like to start by going right back to the beginning and having you tell us about one of your earliest memories of creating art or drawing.
Sure, yeah. That's actually, it's kind of a funny story because the way that all started was I came to Canada when I was 4 years old, and that was 1968. And my mother was working in a retail clothing store when we first got here. One day she came home with this big cardboard box full of comic books. What had happened was another lady at the store had a young teenage son who just refused to clean his room. And this lady finally said, you know what, if you don't clean it, I'm cleaning it out. So she put all his comic books in a box and brought them to the store one day and said to my mom, here, you've got a little boy, he can have these. So, you know, at age four, to suddenly be presented with this giant box of comic books, it was like a treasure chest to me. And I'd never really seen a comic book before, and I was fascinated by them. I was fascinated by the pictures and the colors and the stories in there. And the artwork was so compelling that what I would do is take the sheets from my mom and dad's typewriter. You remember carbon paper that you used to use in typewriters?
Yes, yes.
I'd put that in the pages of the comic book and then trace the pictures of, you know, Spider-Man or Superman off of the comic book pages. And that, you know, seeing those traced reproductions made me feel like, wow, maybe one day I could be a comic book artist. So
well, that is such a neat story.
Yeah.
I bet that other poor fellow never got over the shock.
I still feel bad for that kid wherever he is.
You probably don't know who he is, but that may be for the best. That is a sad but very interesting story. So you trained by copying, literally, the way you see people sitting around in museums copying the masters.
Yeah, absolutely. And to me, as a kid, with my fascination for comic books, the artists who drew those comic characters, they were truly masterful artists. Whether they were working in very cartoony styles like Charles Schulz drawing Peanuts, or whether they're drawing in very realistic styles like you might see in a superhero comic, at a very early age I began to recognize that these artists had tremendous skill and were applying it in a very creative manner. And it was so compelling to me that I felt like one day I would want to grow up and do what these artists were doing. So I began drawing in sketchbooks, trying to draw from life. And then I think I was in grade 7 when my mom and dad bought me a book called How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way. And, you know, I still use that book in my classroom here at Mohawk College.
How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's neat. So yeah. you are teaching cartoon drawing.
I do teach cartoon drawing here, yeah. One of my courses is character design. But more generally, that book broke drawing down into its basic components. It taught you how to draw using basic shapes. And many of the students that come here to Mohawk, to the graphic design program, they may or may not have done a lot of drawing previous to coming here. They may or may not be passionate about it. And almost certainly they feel a little insecure about their ability. And so what I do is I apply those same lessons that I learned all those years ago about using basic shapes as the basic construction blocks of drawing. And I teach them that anybody can draw.
Well, you know, one of my questions for you is about your inborn talent for drawing, because I teasingly said to you, I think the walls of your mother's womb must be decorated, you know, wallpapered somehow. And when I found out today who your mother is, I thought, well, for heaven's sake, so let me just tell our listeners that today my friend Joe is visiting here from BC, and we went to the Carnegie Gallery just to see Will Reuter's show and the other work that was up there. And we walked right into a big tea party for a woman whose name was Ping. And I didn't know who this person was, but I said, Ping? I was talking to Barbara and Nancy there at the gallery, and I was saying, Ping? I'm interviewing a guy named Life Ping tonight, you know, on the show. And they were like, well, that's her son. And I couldn't believe the odds. What would the odds be? Turns out your mother is the person who ran the boutique in Westdale, and she has just retired, and they were honoring her at the Carnegie for her support of artists and art, and you're that person's son.
Yep, so, same family.
Yeah. Incredible. So it's no wonder, really, that you have grown up to be an artist. She must have totally supported that all your life.
Absolutely. Both my parents were always incredibly supportive and encouraging.
Of your drawing and your interest.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they would support me and my sister in whatever we were interested in, for sure. But they could see from a very early age, I was a little obsessed with drawing all the time. But you know, because you sort of began your question asking about sort of a natural talent.
Yeah,
I have some fairly strong opinions about the whole concept of talent and its value.
Good. That Let's comes hear from,
them. Yeah, I've never felt that I had very much natural talent for drawing, but I've always had tremendous ambition and determination to be successful at whatever it was that I chose to do, and this, you know, from a very early age, being the thing that I really was determined to do. I just set about doing the hard work that it would take to learn how to do that thing well. And I met a lot of people along the way, especially at art college, that had tremendous talent. Most of them are not working in the graphic arts today very successfully. And that is really because I feel they, despite their great talent, they didn't necessarily have great desire to do what it is that I do. What I always try to encourage my students to do is, you know, work hard. When you have real determination to be successful, talent, I think, takes a back seat.
Okay, so you feel that there's a combination here, talent
For sure.
and desire.
Yeah, and I think in the graphic arts, the real key component to success is that desire or determination to be successful as a graphic artist.
Okay, so what about the talent? Like, can you say anybody can draw, but can anybody make a living at art?
Yeah,
really?
I really think that you can. And what it takes is, as I said, the ambition to want to be successful at this. And it also takes, I think, a willingness to train yourself to think creatively. Because there are a lot of people who get into this business who perhaps have not had the opportunity to think creatively, and therefore maybe are not driven to think creatively. And so what can happen in that case is that they could end up doing more technical jobs in the graphic arts as opposed to the more creative parts of the graphic arts.
Okay, so you really do feel anybody can grow up and work as an artist.
For sure,
and be an artist.
And I should make a distinction that when I say, you know, grow up and work as an artist, I do mean a commercial artist, because that's my realm. I'm not talking about the fine arts, I'm talking about commercial art.
Okay, can you just define the difference between fine art and commercial art?
Absolutely, yeah. Fine art is something that we do to fulfill some sort of personal desire to create. And we would do it whether anyone will ever see it or not. It's just a drive to create, whether it's painting or drawing, a piece of music, written piece, whatever it might be. But commercial art is different. Commercial art is craft that has a creative component to it. Sometimes more, sometimes less. But it is the, how would I put it? It's the channeling of creativity into a utilitarian purpose, a commercial purpose. We create for a client for money.
All right, and you do it on by a deadline.
Absolutely.
You know, you wake up in the morning, you know this is the job you're going to do.
Yes.
And so it's a different impulse.
Yeah.
Do you have a fine artist in you somewhere? Do you ever wake up and just think, I'm going to paint clouds today? I don't care if they want, you know, cartoons.
Yeah, I think many of us, maybe most of us who get into commercial art are people who certainly have a fine art ambition. And at the same time, maybe a certain sense of practicality that, you know, we want to make a living. And perhaps the happiest compromise would be to make that living by using our, you know, artistic ability to for someone else's ambitions as well, you know, to ideally collaborate with our client. And sometimes that means relinquishing creative control to the person who is going to pay for the work that's being done.
Okay. You know, I, this is so interesting to me because in a couple of weeks at the end of February, I'm going to actually do a program with my sister who made her living as a commercial artist, a greeting card artist. Mm-hmm. And part of what is so compelling about interviewing her is to hear her talk about how that world has really ended, the world of the in-house artist, where you can go. And she talks in a way that just breaks my heart about how that's gone now, largely because of the computer, but not totally because of the computer, and because of outsourcing to other countries and that kind of thing. So it is really interesting. How do you feel about all of that?
And I experienced it myself almost immediately after getting into the commercial art industry. When I finished art college in the mid-1980s, I guess it was.
At Sheridan, right?
At Sheridan, yeah. My first job was as an in-house illustrator at a large Toronto advertising agency called Ogilvy & Mather. And my job there was to be the visualizer for the ideas created by art directors working on advertising accounts. They would have, you know, very important meetings with clients where they would have to present the concepts for the latest ads those clients wanted on television or in magazines or on billboards or whatever. And rather than just explain their idea to the client, what they wanted was a visual representation of that. They would come to the studio, which was on a different floor, and they'd hand us a brief. You know, this is what we need drawn up. And there are two of us, two young guys, and it was our job to quickly and very effectively draw up those ideas. And then they would be pasted down on a large board.
So they would literally describe them to you in words, and they wouldn't give you anything. That was the art direction.
Imagine a movie script where someone would say, you know, Dad, we see Dad walk into the kitchen, and Mum's getting breakfast ready, the kids are at the table, and, you know, Billy's 7, and Sally is 3, and they smile and, you know, look at Dad, and he sits down, and we would draw, you know, what's called a storyboard, for instance, for a television commercial, and then they would take that to the meeting the next day maybe, and then they'd show the client their idea. They'd show them step by step a progression for what would ultimately hopefully become a 30-second TV commercial. That was great, and it worked out. I mean, I was in heaven. That was what I had always wanted to do. You know, like I said, I had wanted to be a comic book artist, and then life steered me into advertising. But at the same time, I was drawing and being paid extremely well for it, and I was working on huge national advertising campaigns, which is a real rush, you know, especially for a young person to watch a TV commercial 2 or 3 months later and say, hey, I worked on that. I saw that. You know, I saw
That's
the script for that
when it was
just an idea, and here it is filmed and on TV and being seen by millions of people. So that was great. And then came the recession of the early 90s, and the advertising industry, like every other big industry, was absolutely gutted. Many of the people working on staff in the studios, not just at Ogilvy, but all over Toronto and no doubt all over Canada, were called in and told, you know, we need to find efficiencies, and getting rid of your job is one of them. So about a year and a half after starting as an in-house illustrator, and, you know, I just gotten married, we were going to be having a baby, we'd just bought our first house, my studio manager called me in and said, listen, I got to let you go. And the nice thing, the silver lining was that they really did need access to an artist at a moment's notice. So he said, the one thing we can do for you is we can give you space here. They had a tiny little office. And when I say it was the size of a broom closet, I'm not exaggerating. It was absolutely tiny. And they said, you can run your own business out of there, find your own clients, and do the work here. And that way, if we do need you, then we can just, you know, run down the hall and say, look, can you draw this? We need this for a meeting. And rather than pay me, you know, 9-to-5 salary, they would pay me a freelance, contractual, agreed upon wage only for the work I was doing. The rest of the time I was on my own to earn my own income.
Yeah.
The nice side of that for me was that the second year in business, I made twice as much as the first year when I was on staff. because freelancers charge a lot more, you know, when you're not on
staff.
You're
paying for everything.
Yeah, you're paying for everything. Yeah. So it actually worked out, and it forced me to be entrepreneurial, to learn how to market myself, how to promote myself, how to connect with clients and make cold calls and show my portfolio to strangers and be personable and be ambitious, you know, be even more ambitious and more determined to succeed. And it wasn't a bad thing in the end. It was a great move for my career, and for pretty much the next 25 years, that's how I made my living.
Okay, and now you're here at Mohawk College teaching.
Yeah.
So what does that tell us about the industry?
Well, the industry has changed a lot, that's for sure. And many of us who were from, I'll call it the analog world, who were there before the computer, were still young enough to adapt to the digital world. When the technology came in and the work moved onto the computer, we were able and willing to learn that transition. So for me and for most of my friends who are around my age, I'm now 47, we're doing fine. And even the year before I began teaching here, I was doing a lot of work, mostly for clients in New York. I had a rep in New York City, and most of my work was for them. But it is a really frantic business, working in advertising, and the computer made everything faster. And, you know, you reach a certain point where you've done something again and again for 25 years, and every time the phone rings with another job, you know exactly what the client's expectations are. So there are no more creative surprises, and it seems like they just keep wanting it faster and faster. So, yes, the computer has changed everything, and the business has definitely changed for a lot of artists, but there is a ton of work out there for graphic artists today. And I think, in fact, with all of the jobs that are in what, you know, you often hear called the creative economy, there are going to be more and more opportunities, but they are very much 21st century artistic opportunities, not 20th century opportunities.
So what do you mean through the computer? You mean through the computer, freelancing and selling yourself, that's what you mean by 21st century?
Yes, and also the kind of fields that require graphic artists is changing. It used to be the print industry. The print industry still needs some illustration. That's, you know, that's my specialty is illustration, and I still do some illustration freelance on the side now and then. But that portion of the work has diminished dramatically in the last 10 years especially. And I can understand why your sister would have found that sort of thing happening in greeting cards as well, because greeting cards is also a print industry. But online for, you know, websites, for web magazines, for mobile apps, for video games, strangely enough, even comic books,
you know,
graphic novels, things like that, they're all moving into a digital format. You know, the next generation won't read magazines or comic books or books on paper. They will read them on digital tablets. And that doesn't mean that the venues for art will disappear. It means they will have shifted.
It will change.
And one thing that a lot of artists, I think, are struggling with is the fact that the high speed of production that's required when you're working, when you're trying to make a living in the digital world, the expectation now is that everything is instantaneous. So you need to develop strategies to produce work very fast. And if you're an artist with integrity, you obviously want the work to be good. So it becomes a very, very difficult concept to wrap your head around, that I will continue to do good work, but I'll produce it at an incredibly fast pace.
You know? Oh my gosh. Well, I want to go back to what you said a second ago about creativity. You said, you know, like this, there are no more artistic surprises. How does a creative artist, how does a creative mind deal with that? How do you get your hit for creativity now and again?
I think it's, well, I don't know about all artists, but in my case, what I try to do is I try to tie it to entrepreneurship. And you see this with a lot of younger creatives today, that rather than look for work in sort of the traditional realm, like where you think of yourself, as I did, as a young artist looking for a job at a big agency as an in-house illustrator, you need to find your own audience. The world has become very much not so much a mass market as it is a mass market of a million niches. And what you really need to do is find a niche that you're passionate about, because the work you do has to be sincere. The one thing that I think a lot of artists who are successful have discovered is that if you are passionate about something and you pursue that niche, they will embrace your creativity. I mean, like, they will monetarily embrace it. So to give you a couple of, like, sort of general examples, and these are by no means the best, perhaps, but there are artists, and actually this goes back a very long way. There are artists who have, for instance, become specialists in, let's say, Western art.
Yeah.
Where they, you know, they've moved to Arizona and they paint those landscapes and the native people who live there and horses and cowboys and things like that. And they discovered that that niche, that there was a huge market within that niche, that they could fulfill their creative ambitions and at the same time make a good living. And today, there are artists who have discovered, for instance, that they can do a web comic, a daily web comic, where they'll draw maybe four panels of a new episode of their web comic and target it towards a very specialized niche.
Okay.
And one that I could mention for your listeners to check out online is a web comic called Penny Arcade.
Penny Arcade.
Yeah, and the two guys who started that, now they started about 10 years ago. They have such a huge following that they are both millionaires now. And they have their own convention every year where like literally tens of thousands of people come to wherever it is that they hold the convention to, you know, buy and trade and just socialize with other people who share their passion for this tiny niche, Penny Arcade being about video games and the culture of the geek culture of video games, let's say. There are like literally thousands of examples like that.
Yeah. Well, Life Ping, what is your niche that you're passionate about?
Well, that's interesting. My niche that I'm passionate about goes back to when I was at Ogilvy & Mather, when I was working on staff there. I had in that studio, we had this goes to show you how old I am, pre-computer, we had an on-staff photo retoucher, because of course everything that would ultimately end up in a magazine ad or on a billboard had to be photographed if it wasn't being illustrated, and those photographs would often have dust specks on them or what have you.
Maybe airbrushed them.
Yeah, exactly. So this fellow, his name was Bud Fenty, and he's originally from Hamilton as well, by the way. He was an older gentleman, and he had been working in the graphic arts in Toronto since I guess since the end of World War II or shortly thereafter. Yeah, photo retouching was his specialty. And what artists used to do at that time was they would keep a file, a clipping file, of images clipped from old magazines, and they'd file them into categories, you know, men standing, men sitting,
yes,
you know, men lying down, etc., etc.
Yeah,
and cars and trucks,
roses, and bunnies, yeah.
Because without, you know, having Google to search for a picture of something, if a client came and said, you know, I need a woman's hand holding a peach, you know, then you could go to your file folder of women's hands
your
and find
file,
one
yeah.
and one of a peach, and then put them together in your illustration, and, you know, there you go. So we loved looking through Bud's clipping file because it was filled with the old magazine clippings from the Saturday Evening Post and Collier's and all the other magazines of the day. And I became absolutely fascinated with the artwork in those pages.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, fast forward about, I guess, 10 years or so, Bud had passed away, and when his family came to gather his personal effects, they had no use for this big file cabinet full of, you know, magazine clippings. So they sort of bequeathed these folders to myself and my friend, and then eventually my friend gave them over to me as I moved on. And then years passed, and I was now working at home, and the internet had come along. And one day I was flipping through one of these folders, and I came across this absolutely gorgeous illustration. It was actually, I guess, a pinup illustration from an old Esquire magazine, beautifully painted. And I thought, boy, this is so beautiful, and I'm the only one who's ever going to see it, because here it is, stuck in this folder in my studio in Hamilton, in, you know, in our house. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to scan this thing and I'll send it to a few friends. So I scanned it, I attached it to an email, I put in the subject line, today's inspiration, and then I sent it out to about 10 friends who are also artists. Well, almost immediately they started sending back messages, wow, have you got more of this stuff? You know, send something else. So the next day I sent another picture and then another picture. And they would start sending me email addresses of their friends saying, you know, so-and-so would like to be added to this list, and can you put so-and-so on this list? And within the space of about a year, my little list of 10 friends had grown to over 200. And within the space of 5 years, it had grown to 500. And now it's been a little over 10 years, and there are over, I would say, 12 to 1,500 people all over the world who are members of my daily Today's Inspiration email list receiving one of these scans.
So that's what you have on your blog site.
Yeah, I have when blogs came along, I decided to start one because I thought this would be a great way not only to show these pictures, but to also write about the artists who created them, because that had become my passion. I had so enjoyed not only discovering the work of these artists from the 1940s and 50s, but learning what I could about who they were. And what I had discovered was that illustration, you know, the business, the profession I had chosen to get into, was a very different thing half a century ago. And that the artists who created that artwork for magazines like, you know, the Saturday Evening Post, for instance, they were wildly successful beyond my wildest dreams. Many of them were millionaires. They typically were paid $25,000 to $50,000 in today's money, you know, the 1950s equivalent, usually about $2,000 to $5,000 for one illustration.
Wow.
And many of them were doing 4, 5, 6 of those illustrations a month.
Ah, and so this would, I'm immediately imagining the Breck girls, the Breck shampoo used to be. They always had a different girl on the back of the magazines.
Yeah, and the thing about that was that at the time, because television was still a relatively new medium and many people didn't really have television or had very limited access to television, most people in North America got their popular culture from magazines. Mm-hmm. And so imagine, you know, millions of people every week picking up the Saturday Evening Post and flipping through 100 to 150 pages of beautiful pictures, mm-hmm. and then noticing the signatures in the corners and going, oh, I recognize that name, or oh, there's another Breck girl, for instance, right?
Yeah. So, oh, I've lived this.
Yeah, so that made the artists who created that work really celebrities in their own right, and they really did hobnob with Hollywood celebrities, and they often people from Hollywood would ask these artists to paint them into one of their pictures. So there it was an entirely different culture, a very like high-class culture, much different from the kind of anonymity that is more typical today in that business.
Oh, yeah. Well, now, Life Peng, I'd like to get you to tell our listeners how they can find your blog site.
Well, it's todaysinspiration.blogspot.com.
Okay. Everybody out there got that? And is there an apostrophe in today's?
Nope. All lowercase.
Yeah. Okay, todaysinspiration.blogspot.com.
Yeah.
If you want to learn more about these 20th century illustrators that Life Peng is researching, and I must say that the pictures that I saw on there, I thought were quite beautifully done, and two very different, interesting ones that I noticed on there. The names have escaped me, but okay, now you're going to be giving a lecture as well next week, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Toronto, is it?
Yeah, I'll be at a little artists collective called The Nook in Kensington Market, and I'm pretty sure their website is nookcollective.com. I'm not sure, but if you search on Google for The Nook and Kensington Market, then you'll find it for sure. And I'm also going to be including a link on my blog each day this week.
Good. And what are you going to be talking about?
Specifically, what I'm going to be discussing is female illustrators of the mid-20th century. As I've been researching the last few years, I've occasionally come across, and it is occasionally, a woman who was successful as an illustrator at that time. Like many things in the 1950s, illustration, a very high-powered industry, was an old boys' club.
Mm-hmm.
And women who were successful within that club were few and far between. But there were some, and their work is always just spectacular. And I'm fascinated to know that there were women at a time when I think many of us find it hard to imagine what the world was like at that time, that there were certain social parameters that people simply just accepted and didn't cross, certain barriers.
Right.
And these women were strong enough in personality and talented enough to be successful in that kind of environment. So I've researched several of them that I've been able to find out about, and I'll be discussing a little bit about who they were and taking a look at their work.
Can you tell us one or two of the names?
Yeah, absolutely. One of them was a lady named Barbara Bradley, who worked at a New York advertising art studio. In fact, the most highly successful advertising art studio in America at the time is called the Charles E. Cooper Studio. And it was the studio that every artist in America wanted to be a member of. They had a downtown New York office. They had several stories in a 40-story skyscraper office building with their own photo studio, with their own costume wardrobe department, and 70 artists working there, or rather 70 people on staff altogether. And the best artists whose work appeared in all of the major magazines, Ladies Home Journal, The Post, Collier's, all of the magazines that were considered the most mainstream, highest circulation magazines had the Cooper Studio artists work in them. So Barbara Bradley was this young woman who came from LA to New York with her husband, who also had just graduated. And she said, well, if I'm going to work anywhere, I want to work at Cooper's. So she took her portfolio and she went there to have an interview. This was a regular thing. You went on, I think, a Wednesday, and you sat in the office with all the other young artist hopefuls with their portfolios. And they were all men, and she was the only woman. And she watched one go in and come out, each one looking kind of despondent. He'd been rejected. And then finally it was her turn. She was one of the last people in the waiting area. And Chuck Cooper came out and started walking towards her. And then he stopped and said, no, sorry, we don't need any more women artists.
Anymore?
And turned and walked away. Yeah, they had two at the time, in a staff of 70. And the feeling back then was that women were a distraction, and that they wanted the guys to stay focused on their work, and having a young, attractive woman in the office was going to just create problems for them. And then at the last moment, he sort of stopped and turned around and took a second look and said, all right, let me see your portfolio. And of course it was great, you know. And so she actually did get the job, and she started at Cooper's. And then the story I'm going to tell at the Nook on Wednesday night will be the story of where her career went from there.
Oh my gosh. Well, so if people are interested in getting up there to Toronto, do you have to buy tickets ahead, or?
Yeah, they have on their website at the Nook Collective, they have a little thing where you can pay through, I think, PayPal. I'm not sure how it works exactly, but
okay. And that is this coming Wednesday.
This Wednesday,
February,
yep.
10th, is that?
I can't
remember. I think it's the 10th. Anyway, so this coming Wednesday in Toronto at the Nook Collective.
That's right.
And you can find it online and get yourself a ticket and get up there. If you want to hear more of Life Peng, my guest tonight on Art Waves at Indie 101, the new spirit of radio. So Life, this is fascinating, and I am amazed that all this came out of that clip art file of Bud Fenty.
That's right.
Who was a Hamilton artist as well, you say?
Yeah.
That is so neat. Do you have a book that you're working on? You got to.
Well, I think of my blog as my book. It's an ongoing, hopefully endless book that now has well over 1,000 posts, and it's been visited, I think, over 2 million times now.
Oh my gosh.
Last time I counted, from people all over the world.
Well, you said you have 10,000 readers a day.
Yeah, I have about 3,000 who have actually signed up to follow the blog. And then through RSS feeds, I have another 7,000 daily readers to add to the 1,200 or so who receive the actual scan by email every day.
Wow, that is incredibly impressive. Okay, now this is what you mean when you say editorial art of this type is a long and storied field for illustrators. That's what you're referring to? Okay, and you say here, and I just want to quote you, your message to me, your email to me said, it's highly prized work because it allows the most self-expression in a commercial venue as opposed to advertising and packaging, which is heavily client-directed.
That's right, yeah.
So these people were able to find their own voices and have a little more freedom.
Yeah, exactly. Because when you're illustrating a magazine article, the typical process is you receive the manuscript, and the only really instruction you get is interpret this.
Yeah.
And that's really, I think, what the creative artist enjoys the most, is the opportunity to interpret in his own or her own way.
Sure.
And in advertising, it's rather different. In advertising, there have been focus groups. There are certain goals that the advertiser wants to achieve. And so they have very, very specific requirements of the artist. And I've done both. Mm. And editorial's more fun.
Okay, you have also illustrated the cover for Maclean's magazine 3 times, you said.
That's right. Yeah.
Tell me, describe one of those illustrations, I might remember it.
The most fun one was when Maclean's did a story on the legalization of medicinal marijuana. And for the cover, the art director came up with the idea to do a takeoff on the old Reefer Madness movie poster.
Yeah.
So I got to recreate my own variation on that movie poster for the cover of Maclean's, which was really a lot of fun to do.
That's neat. Okay, and you've also illustrated for the interior artwork for Chatelaine, Today's Parent, Owl, Chickadee, Toronto Life, Canadian Business, The Spectator, of course, The National Post, Toronto Star, and too many trade magazines to list. So people have seen your work. Our listeners will have seen the work of Life Peng. They may not know it.
No,
do you get to sign it?
When you do magazine work, you usually get a credit line, almost always. So yes, you don't really sign your work so much these days as they did, you know, back in the 50s, you typically did sign your work. In fact, the Saturday Evening Post had an on-staff artist whose job it was to mimic the artist's signature if necessary and move it further into the picture in case they were cropping the painting and the signature might be removed.
No.
But today, if you work in advertising, then almost certainly they don't want you to sign your work. They want the product to be the hero, not the artist who created the illustration of the product.
Yeah, you're no longer, I guess, in that lovely mid-20th century world where you can become a millionaire and hang out with movie stars and so on because of your artwork. Too interesting. What would be your dream job, Life Peng, in terms of illustrating?
You know, that's really hard to say. I don't think I really have any dream job specifically. There isn't any one thing that I would love to illustrate more than anything else. What I really enjoy doing in illustration more than anything is collaborating with the other partners in the creation of something that is satisfying. In that sense, someone comes to me and they have something that they'd like to achieve. They want to sell a product. They want to advertise something. They want to draw attention to a magazine article, whatever the case may be. And if they're prepared to work with me as a creative partner, allow me to not just render something for them, but to actually introduce my own creative thinking into that process, that's always a dream job for me.
Okay. Now, I read this on your blog, I think, that you recently started playing around with oil landscapes, and you hadn't done that before.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that, and how did that feel?
Well, one of my really great friends is also a local artist named Sylvia Simpson.
I knew when I read it, and you said that you'd gone to the Cloche Mountains, I thought, I bet he was with Sylvia. Yeah. Sylvia's been on Art Waves before.
No doubt, yeah. And, well, anyway, a few years ago, Sylvia was talking about going up to Whitefish Falls, up to the Cloche Mountains, and a bunch of us were having a barbecue or something, and someone said, you know what, that's it, Sylvia. You always talk about how great it is up there. This year, we're going with you. So a group of us and our spouses, we all went together a couple of summers ago, and there's a little camp up there where everyone stays, and there are art lessons that are given by a local wildlife artist. Anyway, so yeah, we went up there together, and the idea is to do painting, you know, en plein air painting. Mm-hmm. And I'd never done anything like that before, but it sounded like it might be a lot of fun. And I'd always wanted to paint with oils. I had a whole bunch of oil paint that I'd bought a few years previous that I never actually dared to open. And I decided, well, this is the perfect opportunity. So the first year I went, I had a few false starts. I created a few small oil sketches and came back feeling a little despondent. But again, as I said earlier, I'm always determined to be successful at whatever it is I try to do. So we went back the second year, and this last summer was very successful. And it was so successful. It was so invigorating that when we returned, my wife and I would regularly go out on an afternoon or a weekend and find a meadow or a nice place somewhere out in the country and paint. And so over the summer, I produced, I think, something in the neighborhood of 15 to 20 paintings.
Wow. Yeah. So you've really taken off with it.
Yeah. And unfortunately, now that school's back, I don't have the time to really do it.
Yeah.
But hopefully this summer coming up, we'll take another trip up to Whitefish Falls and start all over again.
Yeah. I'm kind of amazed that you, as a working artist, that you had never done it before the last couple of years, you know?
Well, the thing is, in advertising, oil is the last medium that you want to work in because it doesn't dry quickly. And it's a slow process to produce good work.
Yeah.
And being so deadline driven, the work that we produce needs to be produced quickly and dry quickly. And now, especially, you know, in the digital age, you can do what looks like an oil painting, even as if it were painted on a canvas using a digital tablet and graphic software program. So I've been painting for years, but I have been painting with a tablet on a computer.
Painting with light.
That's right.
As they say. Well, do you ever, when you're doing your work, your digital work, do you ever work it up on paper first?
Not so much anymore because I have programs now that reproduce pencil and charcoal and Conte and pastel. So when I'm working for clients, when I'm doing commercial work, when it's not personal work, then no, I work, it's entirely paperless.
So you don't have a little studio in your house anymore where you have...
I do.
You do?
I do. I have a fairly large studio in my house, actually.
Not a broom closet anymore.
No.
And what do you do in there?
I one side is my computer and the other side is my drawing table. And my son uses the drawing table side a lot. He's a very talented artist and very driven and produces a ton of work. And he loves traditional media. And then I dabble and play over there as well.
You just sketch something out every now and again.
Just for myself, yeah.
It's kind of interesting to me that you were, as a child, fascinated by these comic books that you received in that box. I mean, really, that mother could never have known what she was going to spark off giving that box of comic books to your mom. But you didn't really veer far from that style, you know, and there's so many kinds of art, you know, it's fascinating that, and of course you went to Sheridan, which focuses too on the practical,
yeah,
like
absolutely.
Mohawk.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I think because of my early influence from comic books and popular culture, it's the thing that I've always really wanted to pursue. And I mean, I had a lot of exposure to fine art because of my family, because of my mother especially, but popular culture really played a huge role in forming my tastes. And so things like comic books and bubblegum cards and movie posters and, you know, all of the things that are, I suppose some people would say, kind of crass commercial visual media, I see a lot of value in that stuff. I see, there's this expression I've heard, which I think came from Russia, called art for the masses.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's what all of that material is. It's art for the masses. And being an artist who creates art for the masses, I can tell you that, you know, my interest and the creativity I bring to the work I do for, you know, crass consumer stuff is entirely sincere. I really do try to invest it with as much creativity as I can, and I know that my fellow artists who create that work do so as well. It's not prostitution.
You are as passionate about your work as any other artist. Well, I can feel that for sure. When you were sitting there in the La Cloche Mountains last summer, or whichever summer, painting the tree and the landscape, the water, deciding whether to put the boat in or take the boat out, and so on, did you feel different than you do when you're sketching your other kind of work, your commercial art?
Well, it's a very relaxing environment. So there's a lot less stress, I would say that. But in terms of the result, I have to say that I always feel the same about the working process, no matter what medium I'm doing or what subject matter I'm rendering or creating. I find it a little mysterious as it's going along. I don't really know where it's going until I get near the end. And as you put those final touches on things and it starts to really take shape and you can actually see it, it becomes immensely satisfying. Where, you know, suddenly it's not just underpainting or abstract shapes, it's starting to actually turn into something, and you think to yourself, yes, you know, oh, okay, and then you add a little bit here and add a little bit there, and more and more you start to feel really great, like energized.
And do you ever feel that you don't know when a piece is finished, or do you pretty well know when a piece is finished?
Yeah, I think there's actually an expression about that a painting is never actually finished. The artist just runs out of time.
just abandons it. Yeah, the artist just runs out of time. So you still feel that way yourself?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's interesting. Well, Live Ping, this has been so fascinating to talk to you. I just want to get you to tell us about the piece of music that you've chosen. It's not the piece of music that you chose originally because we couldn't get that to work with the machine, but you've picked one from Gorillaz, from their compilation, the Singles Collection 2001 to 2011, and it is called Feel Good Inc. Can you tell us why you like that? Why you chose it?
Oh, I really like that particular track by the Gorillaz anyways, even if I didn't know anything about the group. But what I really love about the Gorillaz is that it's a very playful group. It's a non-existent group. And the visual component, the visual realization of the members of the group is a series of cartoon characters created by a cartoonist, a comic book artist named Jamie Hewlett. And the other members of the actual band Gorillaz certainly don't look anything at all like the visual representation that Jamie Hewlett created. What I love about the concept is that it marries popular culture from different areas, from print media and the music industry, and creates an absolutely unique overall vision. And it fascinates me that these artists who came together from completely different fields, from one being a comic book artist, the others being in the music industry, came up with this incredibly clever idea and managed to create such a wildly successful new way of expressing themselves. The Gorillaz is a huge phenomenon all over the world as a result.
Well, I am totally confused about what we're going to hear here. We are going to hear music, right?
I think you're going to like it.
Okay. All right. Well, I certainly hope so. And I certainly like talking to you, Life Ping.
Thanks,
thank you.
I like talking to you too.
Well, thank you so much for being here tonight. It's been great fun and fascinating. And it's really going to work well with my sister's interview in a couple of weeks. So fascinating. All right. And we always thank our wonderful listeners for tuning in as well. And I just want to let you know that next week we're going to be here talking to George and Trudy Down of the Book Band about literary pursuits and how they support writers. And until then, this is Bernadette Rule wishing you a good night on the shores of Lake Ontario. Laughing gas, these hazmat.
my chocolate attack. Shit, I'm stepping in harder this year. Yeah, bear repping in harder this year. Watch me as I gravitate. Ha 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 ha. We gon' ghost town, it's Motown with your sound. You in the blink, gon' bite the dust, can't fight with us. With your sound, you kill the ink. So don't